Good morning. A new administration comes to power on Friday in Washington. Is this the era of make it or break it for Hawaii's delegation? Congresswoman Haleen Hanabusa is in our studio with some answers. And in Hawaii on Friday, the University of Hawaii will hold its response to the inauguration with a day of resistance. So, is this back to the 60s or back to the future? UH Faculty Senate Chairperson Marguerite Butler considers both. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergrift. A trip to Mars will be a social experiment as much as a scientific expedition, and that's where the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation Research Mission on the slopes of Mauna Loa comes in. And we'll get a report on the efforts to reverse the decline of coral reef habitats on Maui from Dr. Bob Richmond.
It's Tuesday, January 17th. Stay here for the conversation coming up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We're seeing all kinds of resistance to the new presidents coming in, aren't we? It's really unprecedented.
Well, I guess unless you look back several generations, you might find some of that. I'm thinking about some of the things that you might have experienced when you were a young college student.
Well, I just read that the approval rating for the incoming president is far lower than anything on record.
Well, and that may be reflected quite well in what we're going to see Friday, Saturday. Yeah. And the real question is, what happens beyond that? We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, some of you may not be going to work on Friday. Others may choose not to buy anything. Since the November election, the plans for a day of resistance in activity and purchases have included call-outs from the American Civil Liberties Union, Planned Parenthood, the Southern Poverty Law Center, World Can't Wait, and UH Manoa. A resolution passed by the Faculty Senate a month ago gives their reasons why, including that, quote, the election campaign and continuing strategies of the president-elect were and are based on divisiveness, racism, xenophobia, the undermining of civil rights, the passive acceptance and an active encouragement of such, and a willful disregard of fact and historical and scientific record. It's a lot of list. Marguerite Butler is the chair of the Faculty Senate. She's in our studio now. That's a lot of stuff on that list, but it seems to capture some of what we've been hearing coming out of the university. How did this Hawaii J20 group get started by students and faculty members to move it to this point?
Well, it's a grassroots movement, so it actually is separate from the Senate. And people just, I think, got so outraged that, or concerned. It's really fear that that the new administration is going to govern by attacking experts and professors and any kind of knowledgeable person, you know, if they disagree with their policy positions. So that's what really raised the level of alarm. And so it's a grassroots organization that banded together a bunch of socially minded people, and then they came to the Faculty Senate, which is the governance body of the entire faculty, to ask for our endorsement and support of a day of resistance. And so the faculty debated the issue and felt that it was really important to stand up and make a strong stance in support of free speech.
Why this time as opposed to other times when there might have been perhaps some similar issues, but maybe not necessarily because of a change of administration?
I think people are seeing that, you know, like, for example, when the cabinet picks started to get announced and then names of climate scientists were requested, for example, that just sent a really chilling effect on scientists everywhere. And then after that, the names of people working on gender issues was requested from, you know, for career employees. So it's pretty clear that that it's important to stand up and say that these kinds of tactics are not right, and that we, you know, politics is politics, but evidence and careful study and open debate is something that we all have to stand for.
Many of the things you just talked about have been politicized. So we've also heard from scientists and other faculty members who say, you know, it's time that we come out of the ivory tower and do something. Clearly, this is going to be something to do on Friday, the teach-in, a movement that involves students and faculty, other concerned members of the community. But what happens after we get through Friday and the inauguration and then Saturday and the march? Galvanizing people to do something on a particular day is one thing, but what I'm really asking you is, what happens to keep people's interest in moving forward, particularly if you're talking about the Faculty Senate?
Well, as faculty, I think it's going to be a real wake-up call and self-reflection about how do we do education and are we doing enough to arm people with the critical thinking skills to really be able to not just go by what people say, but actually to look at what they do and what the evidence is for these different positions and whether they change over time. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, we're clearly going to have to be much better informed, and we're going to have to really keep ourselves informed in terms of what's going on. As a faculty member, I'm very concerned about the attacks on the press and the attempts to keep the press out. And so how are we going to get the critical information that we need? I'm also very concerned about the attacks on education, the funding of education. You know, and the notion that people should just be trained to do a particular task. I mean, how will we ever improve as a society if we don't train people to really push fields forward?
You're a scientist.
Yes.
So for you, this may resonate perhaps a little differently than if you were part of another discipline. We've heard from scientists who have said, you know, I'm concerned about this, but the issue of, you know, climate change really isn't necessarily my discipline. Other scientists have said, yes, but if you're going to see one discipline challenged, you're going to have to understand that at some point it may be all disciplines that will be challenged. How do you make that point within the Faculty Senate, or is it already resonating beyond just having the march on Saturday and the day of resistance on Friday?
I think that faculty are aware about, because there have been so many denials of facts on so many issues, it's pretty obvious that if we don't stand for the denial of one kind of fact, it's all going to go down. So I think that's pretty clear. The question, though, is, you know, how to do this and how to communicate that out to the citizenry so that people can make the best decisions for themselves.
That seems to suggest that you see this as being very much an all-or-nothing situation, where the Faculty Senate is going to be called upon in future, and faculty, as they teach, and students will be feeling, you know, perhaps more pressure to engage.
It's really sobering to realize that a lot of people are getting. I think what brought home this, what's going on in society to me, is realizing how much people are getting all of their information from social media now. And so that's going to be something that, I don't really have a good answer for how we're going to do that, to try to get people to focus on evaluating the source of information and having quality.
So what will you tell your students, just from your perspective and the students you engage with and the other faculty members that you speak with regularly?
I always ask them, why? How do you know that? How do you know that that's not true? You know, defend your position. Don't just take the first thing you see, and don't just take the first thing that someone says.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the time this morning. We'll be watching what happens on Friday, Saturday, and certainly well beyond.
Thank you.
Marguerite Butler is the chair of the Faculty Senate. It voted to support the UH Day of Resistance. She's also helping to organize a teach-in at the event.
8 years of hope for the world and American leadership ends on a surprising note.
Not in the place where he or his advisors would have wanted the conversation to be when it comes to America's role in the world.
The incredible shrinking superpower is how some have described the Obama years. What now in the age of Trump? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:14. Coming up, adapting to life on Mars, but first, a run at your backyard quiz.
Next in the program, we'll be hearing about the next mission of a project that's simulating manned Mars missions right here in Hawaii. That mission will take place on the slopes of Mauna Loa, fittingly located right next to another major hub of astronomical discovery in Hawaii, Mauna Kea. The White Mountains' globally isolated location, high altitude, and clean air make it one of the best locations on Earth for astronomical observation. The many observatories on Mauna Kea's summit have contributed to such discoveries as pinpointing the center of the Milky Way galaxy, identifying the first known exoplanet, and detecting methane on Mars. One such observatory on the summit of Mauna Kea consists of twin telescopes that are among the largest optical and near-infrared instruments in the world. Today, we're looking for the name of that observatory, and if you know it, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm Brian Watanabe from Pacific New Media. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
America's upcoming mission to Mars will take it into unknown territory in a number of ways, not least of them as a test of human endurance. In NASA's words, quote, astronaut crews far from Earth will rely on a social resilience and team cohesion previously untested in deep space. In other words, they're going to have to be able to put up with each other in close quarters in a long-duration mission that will challenge them in ways that are all but impossible to anticipate. But forewarned is forearmed, and that's why the NASA research program, known as High Seas, for Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, is so important. Brian Ramos is a member of the crew, which will be simulating Martian conditions on the north slope of Mauna Loa, and he's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Brian.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Only a couple of days left on Earth, huh?
Yep, only a few days. So we're getting our last couple days of training in, doing some geological studies, and then we'll be locked in.
And essentially what you're doing is spending 6 months on the slopes of Mauna Loa in a geodesic dome like a Martian habitat, right?
Correct. We'll be doing eight months in isolation, and we'll have some limitations. So we'll have communication delays, 20 minutes each way, and lots of other challenges we'll be doing. What we call EVAs, going outside in our simulated spacesuits and doing some studies.
So you have the what does a spacesuit weigh these days? I mean, they're pretty cumbersome, aren't they?
The real deal are ours. We actually have simulation suits, so they're not the high fidelity, the full blown things. But we did do a test run, and they are quite hot and kind of awkward to walk in, and so we'll have to adjust to that.
But obviously on Mars, you won't be able to even think of going outside without them.
That's correct, yeah.
And
so
just...
We'll be doing...
Go ahead.
We'll be doing the same thing here. So in the simulation, we'll always be in some sort of encapsulated environment, so we don't leave without the suits once the simulation starts.
What's the approximate size of the space you're going to be in?
I believe they said there's two floors, so 1,200 square feet, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's our six bedrooms, living, working area, all that stuff, the bathrooms, and
There aren't that many precedents for this in terms of allowing people to study the effects of that amount of time in a closed space, are there?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I'm wondering what precedents there are for this kind of study of the effects of, you know, human interaction in a space like that.
Yeah, so there are a few different isolation environments that they have going on. We have ones in Antarctica. There are some going on over in Europe. So it's actually very, very important in trying to understand what the future astronauts are going to be, some of the challenges that they're going to have in being able to complete this sort of thing.
And some of the challenges are just flat-out psychological, creating a small human society and having it sustainable, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. A very large challenge of it, a very large part of the challenge is actually psychological, because you're away from Earth, you're away from home. You also have, again, these communication delays so that you can't Skype with your family, you can't, speak to people if you have a problem. Contacting mission control takes a long time. So, for example, if you have an emergency, you can't just call down and say, hey, what do we do? You have to have this increased autonomy, this increased ability to deal with emergencies on your own.
And are you at some point? Might you face the possibility of a simulated emergency as a further test of your kind of social resilience?
It's a possibility, sure. I mean, we'll certainly, I'm sure, have some challenges. At times maybe communications go down or something like that. If that happens, we have to figure out how to work around it as a team. And that's part of the training that we're going through now, is how to handle issues like that.
Are there, what does that training consist of? I mean, it would seem difficult to train people in human interaction.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, part of our training now, we're looking at the studies that we're going to be doing, the data that's going to be collected, and how to go about our day. We're also doing geological studies so we can kind of understand the science and how to go about our particular work. And then some of it, honestly, is just team bonding and that building that team cohesion, learning how to work with one another, learning each other's kind of tics, and that all helps to open that line of communication so that, you know, when we need to speak to each other or there's a conflict, we can go ahead and deal with it properly.
And you all have different but somewhat overlapping scientific specialties as well, right?
That is correct. Yeah, so, we have our team is fantastic. I mean, I'm extremely impressed with these guys. They have, as you said, very specific abilities, but also, you know, we all have a common interest and common kind of ways of tackling issues, tackling problems and challenges. So, so far, we've worked together very well, so I'm very excited to be locked in with these guys.
Well, you know, one of the things that builds team is just the flat-out fact that you need each other, right? You need one another's specialties to complete the mission, I would think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think we've been seeing that because even throughout the week, sometimes even just in a ride to our next location, you know, we're talking, joking around, but also, you know, bringing up little challenges and little things that we foresee happening. And I think that, you know, everybody's kind of concerns and excitement is kind of pushing us together relatively quickly.
I would think so. You must have ways to make room for a little bit of physical exercise within the habitat, I would think.
Yes, yes. So we have an exercise plan, so we'll have to exercise. I think right now it's about 90 minutes a day, except for days that we go out in the suits. So cause some of those days will be a little bit more strenuous. So, yeah, we do have to have an exercise plan so that we stay healthy while we're in there.
I would think that would also contribute greatly to psychological well-being as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very vital. And you'll see the astronauts on the International Space Station also have similar plans where they have to work out every day. And part of that is because of the effects of microgravity, you actually have muscle loss and bone loss. So you have to be careful and make sure you stay in good shape.
Now, this life on the habitat is after you've made the journey, right?
That is correct. So in our mission, we've essentially landed, and we're, you know, surveying the site. So this is actually in a habitat on the planet is what we're simulating.
But the journey itself is going to have you folks in a small space together for a good long time. You will arrive already having experienced a lot of this, I would think.
Correct. Yeah, the journey right now, yeah, would take many months. So that's a big part of it, and the return as well.
Well, it's certainly going to be I'd love to talk to you again when you emerge 8 months from now, but it's going to be a fascinating. It should be fun. Thanks a lot, Brian, for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Brian Ramos is a graduate of the International Space University, where he earned his master's in International Space Studies. On Thursday, he and five other crew members will enter a geodesic dome atop Mauna Loa on the island of Hawaii as part of an 8-month research study of human behavior and performance.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
In past legislative sessions, we've heard from condo owners who say they need some help dealing with their associations. This session, they just might get it. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
When we've talked to condo owners who have called us and told us their woes and their troubles with their associations, and they feel so belittled, they feel so small, they feel they can't possibly take on this huge group of people, both in their association and perhaps in the association's management, it's almost as if they're asking for some sort of referee between their needs and what they're hearing from their association or management. Is that really on the docket this time for the legislative session?
We'll see whether it gets a hearing or not, but there is some support for an ombudsman, an office, so that condo owners can turn to that office for help when they're having disputes. Anita Hofschneider, for example, talked to a condo owner out at Pearl Ridge Gardens and Tower, and he didn't belong to the board, but then he found out his maintenance fees were going to jump nearly 50%. Why? What was going on there? And, well, the only alternatives they really have is one, they can pay them. They can go into mediation. They can hire an attorney. The state can help a little bit, the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, but it's limited. There's no hotline. So maybe having an office, an ombudsman, a referee, as you say, might be a way to help condo owners. It is similar, the bill that's being proposed, to what exists in Nevada. By the way, there's a bunch of bills that are being proposed or considered for condo owners at the legislature this session.
So why should lawmakers get involved with this?
Well, it's interesting. Anita talked to Matt LaPresti, a representative who has a condo out in Eva, a townhouse, and he's at that Haseko complex. Well, same deal with him. Maintenance fees increased as well. You remember that they were going to build a marina, but then they said, no, it's going to be a lagoon, and then there's lawsuits filed. LaPresti is involved with that. So he's actually going to introduce an omnibus bill. It's something that affects a heck of a lot of people here in the islands, given that home ownership buying a house is so expensive. Condos, townhouses, apartments are the better route. Now, whether lawmakers are going to adopt this, we'll see. But they themselves are getting involved in these disputes, and so they have their own personal interests as well as representing their constituents.
Nothing like getting a personal experience with that to be able to show you what everybody else may be dealing with. But I can't imagine that the management associations are particularly happy about having somebody else going to bat for condo owners.
They're not. Anita spoke to a lobbyist for one of those organizations. They said, look, it's a waste of money. We actually had an omnibus, rather a condo court some years back, and it only handled a few cases. This person actually described their problem as being fake news, that really it's being exaggerated. But at the same time, he and the association are looking at clarifying condo laws to try and see, for example, who should be allowed to speak or even attend a board meeting. So it's going to be a topic. Roz Baker, by the way, the senator from Maui, is somewhat skeptical of an ombudsman office. She says that one thing needs to be done for condo owners is you got to read the law. You got to know what the law says. It's a little complicated, but do we really need to expand the bureaucracy?
No, but maybe we need some sort of explainer who can help with that, because it can be dicey looking through all of
yes,
that stuff.
Can.
Thanks very much, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
For the Earth, it was just a twinge. So begins the New York Times Magazine story on the Indonesian tsunami, now adapted into a haunting new chamber piece by local composer John Magnusson and performed by the Haven Trio. Join them for the Honolulu premiere of Twinge in the Atherton Studio on January 21st by calling 955-8821 during business hours or reserve seats at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
By the end of the week, Hawaii Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa will be back in Washington for the inauguration of Donald Trump. What happens after the festivities, for many, seems shrouded in uncertainty. Some issues are clear. The Affordable Care Act will not stay in its present form, and Democrats and Republicans will likely not see eye to eye on foreign policy, defense spending, and perhaps much of anything else. So where does that leave Hawaii's bluer-than-blue congressional delegation? Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Thank you for having me, and let me make my apologies to your listeners. I'm suffering from what I call vulgitis. I'm just not in shape to deal with it like I used to be able to. So my apologies if you hear me cough or it sounds very strange.
Well, right? I think as long as you're in shape to deal with everything else, people will probably
yes.
give you a buy on that one. But in a recent Washington Post interview, President-elect Trump said his goal for his replacement plan for Obamacare is, quote, insurance for everybody. He also said that his almost finished but as yet released plan features, quote, much lower deductibles and a much simpler form, though not single payer. Some have suggested it's more of a Medicare for all. The GOP is saying that whatever it proposes to replace the Affordable Care Act won't leave stranded, you know, those who gained insurance through the ACA. What does whatever come next have to include to be able to get your support?
Well, first of all, we have to understand what the process is. So you hear this term reconciliation, which is really, I think, the only way you're going to be able to get any kind of change. But reconciliation is a budgetary process, and in order for it to be used, it can only, because this is the Byrd rule in the Senate, it can only be used to do affect debt ceiling, spending, and revenue taxes. Those are the only things. So if you look at the committees that have been tasked, by the 27th, by the way, to come up with the quote, the savings, $4 billion worth of savings, it's on the House side, it's Ways and Means, the taxing committee, and the Environment and Commerce, which is Energy and Commerce, which is the committee that has health care. So what people should know is that because things that people like in the plan, which is having your child on the plan till 26, women will not pay more than men, and also the big one, pre-existing conditions, those are considered not covered under reconciliation. In other words, they are mandates to the insurance company, but not the federal government. So because of that, those should not be affected. What does that mean? That means that, and this is the problem, the shortcoming of all the GOP plans, is how do you go about paying to keep these things that everybody wants in light of what they claim to be cutting? And, you know, in other words, repeal and to reinstate. The one thing that I'm hoping that they keep their word on is that they will repeal and reinstate their plan or to create their plan almost simultaneously. I think Trump said 1 hour. And Paul Ryan said we cannot repeal without having a plan. So hopefully we will see this, but they will not be able to repeal the whole thing using reconciliation. They will only be able to repeal portions that affect government spending. And like I've always said, the real danger is Medicaid, the expanded Medicaid, which has major implications for Hawaii, as well as the fact that we have been able to extend the life of Medicare by 11 years because of the Affordable Care Act.
At this point, when we're looking at sort of piecemeal changes and dismantling, there's also the issue of, well, what does happen to a state like Hawaii that depends on Medicaid so much?
You know, I've always had this issue about what happens to Hawaii, because as people know, one of the things that I've always said is I never understood why Hawaii did not avail themselves of the exemption within the Affordable Care Act for our prepaid health.
Well, we were told that it would be embarrassing for you know, the president's home, if you will, to not comply or not be in a leadership position with that.
Well, you know, that's very unfortunate, because so Hawaii gets penalized because we have the best plan in the nation. And, you know, I sat on an oversight and investigation committee hearing where we were talking about, remember the statements about $204 or $205 million to maybe sign up 8,000 people? And that was the exchange. And in that discussion, it was with Mr. Tom Matsuda, who was the acting person. It was like, well, why haven't we availed ourselves of the exemption in Affordable Care Act, in Section 1560. And now they're saying, well, we're going to do this wonderful, innovative plan, which is Section 1332. But Beth Ann, our innovative plan is is our prepaid. So why not having done that before? And that's one of the things that I've told them. So for Hawaii, the whole issue of the ACA's impact, yes, it has major implications on with everyone else. But the major part of it is the fact that we have a plan that works. And for some reason, we've turned our back on it and decided, okay, we're going to make these things now function. And as you know, the governor got an exemption under Section 1332, the innovative one, but it's really for small business. And that's another thing that people did not realize, is that when they did the Affordable Care Act, what happened with small business is the age discrimination. People in Hawaii who are small business owners tend to be older, tend to have very loyal employees who've been with them forever. So when they get assessed the premiums, they get assessed the highest premium because of age versus the younger group. And, you know, I've always felt that what's necessary for any kind of plan to survive is the ability to risk share, and we've lost that.
Do you have in your mind any sense of how Democrats are going to function in the splintered but obviously very Republican majority? And specifically, what's your perspective on how the Hawaii congressional delegation should approach those in Congress who believe in Trump We Trust?
Well, I think that that's something that we will have to wait and see as to what exactly is the Trump White House going to do and how their plan, both his plan and for us in the House, Paul Ryan's plan, because Paul Ryan was a budget chair for a very long time. And in addition to that, he did do Ways and Means for us. So I think that we're going to have to wait and see. But I'm hoping that we'll find some kind of common ground, because they'll realize, Paul Ryan, I think more than anyone, will realize you can't have all these wonderful things that people want, but you have to have the money.
You got to pay for it.
You got to pay for it.
Okay, I want to move on and ask you about one more thing before we let you go. The Obama pivot to Asia has by necessity been more of a foot in the Middle East and one in the Pacific. Shortly after the election, President-elect Trump met with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, which seemed to telegraph Mr. Trump's intent to focus on Asia. Now, we've also watched relationships continue to change. We've seen this in the Philippines, mm-hmm. also the increased tension over Chinese military grasp of the South China Sea. And we've heard some tough talk very recently about that from Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson. Do you see the U.S. pivot to Asia going forward? How do you see that happening? And do you believe that Mr. Tillerson will be confirmed?
You know, I can't tell about how the Senate dynamics are working. I do believe, for example, General Mattis will be confirmed. I think that it looks like Tillerson will also be confirmed. I think Sessions may be confirmed. And this is only because of the fact that people want to, I think, give them a chance, so to speak. Sessions is difficult because he's one of them. He's a senator. And, of course, Elaine Chao for transportation, critical for Hawaii, is also going to be confirmed because she's McConnell's wife. So, you know, it's not going to be wise for anyone to not confirm her, I think. So having said that, I think the danger in all of that is Trump seems to be saying the right things. But underlying all of that, one of the greatest fears I have is I also believe that Trump seems to advocate for isolationism.
And with Asia?
Especially with Asia. Because he's going to have to decide. Remember, the PACOM, what they call AOR, Area of Responsibility, is 55% of the Earth's surface. The three greatest economies are the United States, China, and Japan. But also bordering it is Russia. And we know he has an amazing relationship with Russia. So I'm not quite sure what he's going to do. Right now, China is a target of his. But whether China continues and North Korea continues, that's going to be a different story. And whether he turns around and says to South Korea and Japan, you take care of that. That's going to be the issue for us.
I want to thank you for coming in, especially the way you're feeling today.
Oh, thank you
very
much.
We'll talk to you when you get back to Washington.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
U.S. Congresswoman Colleen Hanabuso was sworn into the 114th Congress last November and represents Hawaii's 1st District, which consists of urban Honolulu.
I'm Nate Lampley from Iona Contemporary Dance Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name a dual telescope observatory on Mauna Kea that has been involved in some of the most significant astronomical discoveries of the modern era. The first telescope came online in 1993, with the second following 3 years later, 9 years after construction of the complex began in 1985. Each telescope uses 36 individual hexagonal mirrors, all coordinated to work as a single unit. It's accomplished by adjusting the exact position of each mirror to a tolerance of 4 nanometers. That's roughly 1/1,000,000th of a meter. The mirrors are attuned to a precise section of the night sky using lasers that adjust for the optical distortion of Earth's atmosphere. That precision, combined with the geographic suitability of Mauna Kea, have helped the W.M. Keck Observatory to become one of the most important celestial observation tools for scientists around the world.
And Beth Ann Scott Weedy of Kailua knew the answer, the W.M. Keck Observatory. So he gets a prize, and at 8:45... That's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Maui's coral reefs are under siege from any number of human impacts, and nearly a quarter of them have been lost in the last 20 years. As such, they're a bellwether for the state of reefs in Hawaii and the world. And last week, the Maui Coral Reef Recovery Team met to outline ways the reef can be saved. We spoke with Dr. Bob Richmond, chair of the Maui Coral Reef Recovery Team, about its findings and about the path ahead.
Personally, I'm an optimist. Professionally, I'm a pragmatist. And the reason why is I can't get out of bed in the morning without a certain degree of optimism, and I can't do my job if I'm not a pragmatist.
Well, pragmatically, you see solutions, right?
Oh, absolutely. When we take a look at what we describe as the state or actually the plight of coral reefs right now, there's no question we've seen a downward trend for quite a while now. And certainly in Hawaii, we see it in coastal waters, everything from runoff from land. We've all seen those brown water events.
Yeah.
So land-based source of pollution, everything that's used on land today ends up in the ocean tomorrow. And we know that's wreaking havoc with everything from burial of corals outright to feeding the algae and allowing those to overcome areas to interfering with the ability of corals to reproduce and to persist. Overfishing is a very big issue for Hawaii. And we see the extraction of very important groups of organisms, the lawnmowers of the sea, that would normally keep algae in check, and they're overfished. And then finally, we've had climate change impacts. The last few years have seen horrible bleaching events that have taken out large areas of coral. Some have recovered, but many areas have not.
It doesn't take much of an alteration of water temperature to do serious damage, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we know right now what the causes are. We also know what the solutions are. And it comes down to political will, whether or not we have people in positions of authority that are willing to use the knowledge that's available and do the right thing.
Well, given, given the climate for science generally, are these findings taking hold? Are they taking hold with the public? What kind of responses do you get when you...
Yeah, we track this very carefully. I think part of the problem has been scientists traditionally have not communicated as clearly as they could have with the general public. The fact that a lot of people still are confused about the issue, some of it is what we call manufactured uncertainty. And this throws back to the days of the tobacco industry and oil industry and others of purposely manipulating and misrepresenting information. And I think people saw in the last election false information that's touted all the time.
Sure.
But I think most people do understand that there are real problems going on. It's a little bit harder when it's a future issue. There's been a number of studies on the psychology of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Most people look at it as a future event, but it's here today. And if you talk about all of the problems that come with climate change, from water shortages and crop failures and people being displaced due to sea level rise, those are pretty catastrophic. But if there's a bee buzzing around in the room, people are going to be focused on the bee because it's right now. And I think people need to understand that it's not game over. And I think that's one of the messaging issues with the scientists. I was the convener for the Coral Reef Symposium we had here last June with over 2,500 participants from 97 nations. And the overwhelming consensus was that corals are in trouble, but they're not doomed. And we have every opportunity to turn around the downward trend right now.
Well, because that puts it in perspective. Whenever you hear the downward trend described, it just seems almost hopeless.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the messaging. Human health and reef health are completely consistent with one another. That, first of all, for a place like Hawaii, coral reefs are critically important. They're the goose laying the golden egg. They're valued at over $36 million a year in revenue to the state. They provide all kinds of ecosystem services, including protection of shorelines, so that people recognize that when humans get sick, you take interventions to try to fix it. If it's a matter of people that are smoking cigarettes, drinking too much alcohol, we can do changes in our lifestyle and we can see immediate returns in our own health. Sometimes we're in a sicker state. We need to have other treatment. Same for coral reefs, is that coral reefs as a ecosystem are sick right now in many areas, and we know what we need to do to prescribe the right kinds of actions and activities to turn that around.
When you were describing earlier the effects of dumping, effluent into the ocean, how damaging is that by comparison with the human impacts of just people walking on the reef, as we see so much on Oahu?
Yeah, it's a matter of scale. When people walk on the reef, which is a terrible thing to do, it's pretty localized just along that track. When you look at the kind of runoff that we see from land, we have the worst system for drainage I've ever seen anywhere in the world.
Really?
It's a very effective system. If you wanted to design a system to kill coastal reefs, you couldn't do better than Hawaii. We have these concrete runways from the mountains to the sea, and every time it rains, we have, in one case, we do studies in Monolua Bay. After one big rainstorm we had in December 2008, we had over 20 tons of sediment deposited to a mid-channel reef off of the Hawaii Kai Marina. No coral reef can withstand that.
There have been other stories like that over the years, and it's a devastating effect, right?
Yes, and I think that's why one of the reasons I'm here today is I chair the Maui Coral Reef Recovery Team. This is a group of people that's come together under the leadership of the Maui Marine Resource Council, Maui Nui Resource Council, and a group of scientists, managers, stakeholders, cultural practitioners, all focused in on the same thing. What do we know, and how do we put that information to use to ensure, in the case of Maui, the sustainability of Maui's reefs? And now there's efforts. The governor signed at the World Conservation Congress an effort to move forward on what's called 30 by 30. 30% of Hawaii's coastal areas well managed by the year 2030. So I think the political will is here. The communities want to do things. And the partnership between scientists, managers, stakeholders, educators, cultural practitioners can actually make it work.
Given all those pieces coming into place and you start tomorrow, what are your immediate steps?
Several things that we have good tools now, and fortunately we have really good managers in the state. In particular, I have to say how impressed I am with the people that work for the Division of Aquatic Resources on Maui. Russell Sparks and Darla White are exceptional in terms of the work that they do and their interactions with the community. And that's being able to get people to engage on recognizing that the oceans are not the cornucopia that will yield everything forever at the rates that are unsustainable. So getting what are called community marine managed areas together where community has input, it doesn't mean complete closures, but being able to limit certain activities that we know take out the herbivores, the lawnmowers that are most important, letting fish get to a size where they can reproduce and begin to replenish the populations. And a lot of it now is focused in on infrastructure. Land-based development can occur, but it needs to be done properly with the on-site retention of water. And what we see is a lot of areas where land is cleared and erosion takes place and we have tons of sediment, pesticides, household chemicals going to the ocean. The ocean simply can't be the recipient for all of the waste. And what we're really doing is turning an asset, fresh water, into a liability when it comes to our coastal marine resources.
Oh, the ironies of the Hawaiian Islands being places in which that is managed badly are many.
Yeah, and there's no reason why we can't turn that around, too. In a world of climate change where we expect right now the 2-degree would be good if we can stay there. A lot of us are looking at the data. The 2-degree temperature change doesn't seem to be the range in which we're going to stop it at the moment. But just think about what that means. The condensation point for clouds goes up about 800 feet. Clouds are not hitting the Ko'olau Mountains, so we don't get the same amount of rainfall. But when we do get rainfall, it comes in large amounts. So it's not what we call the mean value, the common value average. It's these extreme values, the way I like to explain it. You can have a glass of wine a night for a year. That's 365 glasses of wine in a year, and that's not a problem. If you had 85, 90, 100 glasses of wine in a night, you're dead. And that's exactly what we're doing to our reefs. So better on land retention of water, because it is a precious asset. And I've never been on the Kalani-Aniole Highway where it hasn't been dug up somewhere. If we start doing water collection under the roads on these sites as well, that not only protects our coastal reefs, but it gives us the water we need into the future.
Dr. Bob Richmond is chair of Maui Coral Reef Recovery Team and director of UH Manoa's Kiwalo Marine Laboratory. You can read about his team's findings at MauiReefs.org.
What does the public in Hawaii Public Radio mean? It means we're available to everyone and free of commercial influences. It means reporting to help you be a more informed decision maker, whether it's political hearings of national importance, in-depth coverage of events here and abroad, interviews that provide insight and context. Your financial support puts all of that on the air. If you're already an HPR member, mahalo. If you're yet to contribute to make this important public service possible, please go to our website today and thank you.
Beth Ann, Dr. Bob Richmond of the Maui Coral Reef Recovery Team described the state of coral reefs as threatened but not doomed. And there really are a lot of reasons to hope. But it does require a whole change in consciousness on the part of people.
He also had some very pointed things to say about wastewater management, though.
Yeah, he said it was about as poorly managed here as it is anywhere. And that's extremely ironic, you know, given our history.
And given what we depend on for people to enjoy when
sure.
they come to Hawaii.
Sure.
So the real question is, where do we go from here?
Well, they have outlined some steps. They're on a website, and they're really, you know, the posture of his team ends up being an optimistic one, in spite of all the doom and gloom figures that they've assembled. There's reason to hope, but we have to really take it very seriously. As he said, it comes down to political will.
And the action to follow up that political will, where we go with that. We'll take a look at that, and we'll post that for you if you want to have a look at the website, too.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, really curious about what actions follow up a lot of what we've talked about for years and years about how threatened our coral reefs really are.
A lot of things we need to stop doing. That's one of the actions.
Well, as Greta Abbey from UH Manoa has often said, you know, control what you can control.
Yeah.
And that means our actions. So we'll
exactly.
see how that translates. For the moment, we're going to translate into saying goodbye, but we will be back tomorrow morning. Contributing editor Neil Milner will take on fake news.
And we'll have a musical concert featuring Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander songs performed in a dozen different languages.
In the meantime, if you want to be in touch, we've got lots of ways for you to do that. Probably the best way is leaving a message on our talkback line in your own voice. Leave us your name and also the town from which you're calling. That number is 808-792-8217.
And we post a podcast and the music playlist for each show on the Hawaii Public Radio website. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.